Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with Jim Chapin, he's a political historian, vice chair of the Democratic Socialists of America, and national political analyst from the left of the United Press International. Welcome, Jim.
Hello.
The Democratic left has had uneven fortunes in past times of war. There have been disasters for the left during World War I and then kind of advances during World War II and Vietnam. What do you think the fortunes are for progressive politics during this coming war on terrorism?
Well, if this is indeed a major wars almost invariably strengthen the hand of government, lead to the creation of new social programs of one sort or another. That perfect example is the Civil War, which we often don't think of, or for that matter, the War of 1812. After the War of 1812, America created a whole set of national institutions, including the military academies, the first tariff for revenue, internal improvements. Certainly, the land grant colleges, the railroad system, and so on, were built as a result of the Civil War. World War II brought the United States out of a long period of depression and started a period of more than 30 years in which the average income of the average American tripled. And Vietnam, we often forget that during Vietnam, aside from the left as a political organization, but even Nixon, in many ways, was quite a liberal president. What tends to happen, unfortunately, is after the war is over, then there tends to be a reaction, which usually then the right usually does better, after a war than it does during a war. But during a war, there's a tendency for, in fact, everybody in the garrison has to be fed, so there's a tendency for greater egalitarianism to spread through a country.
So the Democrats, they seem to be pretty worried about 2002, but you don't think they have any necessary reason to be?
Probably not, because for one thing, ironically, although wartime presidents are popular during wartime, almost every war in the Anglo-Saxon democracies in the 20th century, the party that was in power when the war started suffered by the time the war was over. In other words, whether it's the Liberal Party in England in 1914 or the Conservative Party in England in 1939, whether it's Woodrow Wilson's Democrats or even Franklin Roosevelt's Democrats, let alone Lyndon Johnson's Democrats, well, for that matter, even the Kuwait War, remember George Bush was, everybody said, oh, he's going to be reelected smashingly. Instead, he suffered a humiliating defeat just 18 months later. And Winston Churchill was turfed out, right after the war was over. In effect, the English people said, thank you very much, Winston, and elected the Labour Party.
Oh, that's wonderful for historical reasons. But looking out at these alleged anti-war demonstrations, most of which no Democrat would go near with a 10-foot pole, speaking strictly of the progressive or left type people who are participating in these demonstrations, it does seem like there's a huge hangover of historical inertia from the Vietnam era that's really alienated them from the populace and spells real alienation from politics in general.
Well, it's not as if that left has had that much impact in the last decade anyway, I think the thing that's interesting about those demonstrations, as a matter of fact, is not even what's happening now, but remember what happened on September 11th. On September 11th, no one took credit for this. As a matter of fact, we often hear that Osama bin Laden took credit for it now, and if you actually analyze his words carefully, he never said, I did it. He simply praised the people who did it. But in the first couple of days after it happened, nobody took credit for it, not even Osama bin Laden. And so, therefore, it's almost a pure litmus test, and there were people on both the left and right who rush to explain why America deserved this, even if they had no idea who did it and why they did it. So in that sense, it was sort of a test of a sort of reflex anti-American sensibility, which was rather curious. One member of DSA said when he was listening to the demonstrations about a week into the event, he said it sounded as though America had just killed 6,000 people instead of having 6,000 Americans just gotten killed.
The Socialist International, of which DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, is a part, one of the members of that that organization is the Labour Party of Britain. And Tony Blair has emerged as a real leader, not only in Britain, but in all of Europe, siding with the United States. And his speech before the Labour Party conference a couple weeks ago really has been seen as a key speech, a key statement of where social democratic politics can go with this new alliance. What do you foresee for global social democracy, apart from the general fortunes of the left in times of war? Is this going to strengthen the hand of a global social democratic agenda?
It's an interesting question. It's a curious phenomenon in a lot of ways. Clearly, in the case of George Bush, who intended to basically be an isolationist president and was following a sort of unilateralist American policy, sort of like, I don't have to care what anybody else thinks, you know, just what America wants is what we're going to do, whether it's Kyoto or trade or any other issue. In other words, it was basically American unilateralism. He was going to build a missile defense even if nobody else wanted it, and so on. Now Bush has ended up having to run around the world, you know, doing all the stuff he attacked Bill Clinton for doing, and been doing it even more. In other words, he's trying to build a multinational alliance. Now, the nature of that alliance is a strange one because it involves, you know, people of who totally dislike each other and people of totally different perspectives. It'll be multilateral, but whether it'll be multilateral in a progressive way is certainly open to question.
A multilateral realpolitik coalition that ignores human rights could be the downside of this new...
That's quite possible. Now, the danger, though, for Bush and for anybody who tries to follow what I sort of fake realism, is that you don't really have good moral grounds for saying we should fix this problem when you've got some people in your alliance who have the opposite beliefs. In other words, you can't very well say that you know, we're against these people because they're dictatorships when you have a whole bunch of dictatorships in your own alliance. In both World War One and World War Two, in World War One, but the alliance with the Tsar, and in World War Two, the alliance with Stalin, you know, both caused the same kind of problem.
You've written that this war and recession will force us from our radical libertarian ethos of the last decade or two into liberal wartime communitarian ethos. Which particular kind of social policies do you think we should be pushing to accentuate that need to have a more communitarian, everybody's in the same bunker together kind of attitude?
Well, clearly a number of things are already happening along those lines. People are beginning to realize that bailing out the airline companies without bailing out their workers doesn't make sense. Clearly, there are whole sets of policies which involve raising the minimum wage, raising extending unemployment benefits, creating, by the way, and one of the things that's interesting is that the Republicans in House are desperately opposing the creation of a federal security service on the airports. You know, they'd rather keep the present system, and the reason they'd rather keep the present system is that the present system means you have disorganized, you know, low-wage workers instead of well-organized federal employees who would undoubtedly join a union, and they don't want a union of 30,000, you know, trained security workers. They'd rather make us more endangered just so we can't have a union, in effect. So I think you'll find that there are issue after issue where the Republicans will be standing on the wrong side. In a sense, their platform of giving money to the rich and not to the poor doesn't really work in wartime very well.
Also, the national health insurance, it seems like, might get a boost up from this, at least it did from World War II in a lot of countries.
Well, in general, if one looks at the as I said, during wartime, and some of it's purely psychological. Think about this. In other words, if I told you a few days before September 11th that yuppies would be gathering at 14th Street and cheering blue-collar workers as they went to do their job, my wife, who's heads the chief operating officer of the Department of Environmental Protection, were going down there with her workers on the first night, and there are people handing water and flags and food to the workers that went by, and others white-collar people cheering blue-collar people, because when you have to dig out of rubble or you have to go die in Afghanistan or something, it's not some guy in a computer terminal is doing it. It's not the yuppie hero of the 1990s. You know, it's some blue-collar guy, a cop, a fireman, a DEP worker, you know. So, in effect, the mere image of what heroism is has changed from the individual, you know, guy making a computer in his garage to somebody, in a sense, risking his life for all of us to protect all.
speaking today with Jim Chapin. He's a political historian, vice chair of the Democratic Socialists of America, and the national political analyst for the United Press International. In the debates on the left about what we should do, what progressives should do vis-a-vis this war, what kind of positions we should take at any rate, whether we're able to actually do anything about it. But one of the debates has been the relative importance of the UN and various kinds of UN interventions and bringing these criminals before an international court, pursuing a legal intervention rather than a military intervention, which doesn't really exist on the ground yet. What do you think the ethical and political ramifications are of damning the current real opportunities for intervention because they're not the perfect ones? I mean, when is it appropriate to say, I can't go along with this because we really should be doing X even though X isn't on the table yet?
Well, I think the most, let me digress a little bit, because I think the most important thing that one has to establish when one is dealing with one's own people about any issue is to establish that you're on the same emotional wavelength as they are, that the response, that you understand where they're coming from. And I'll give a perfect demonstration of this. In 1988, Bernard Shaw asked Michael Dukakis a question about, what would you do if your wife was murdered? Would that change your position on the death penalty? And if you may remember, Michael Dukakis gave this really abstract answer. And the left often does things like that. I don't mean Dukakis is a leftist, but in this case he was. In other words, it often seems not to come from the same emotional place that other people come from. Now, let me describe Mario Cuomo's answer, who was also against the death penalty. Mario Cuomo's answer to the same question. Mario Cuomo answered the same question by saying, somebody murdered my wife. I've got a baseball bat under my bed. I'd say, give me a swing. Just one swing. And then he would pause and say, but it ought not to be up to me, and then he would go and establish it. A lot of what the left does, in other words, doesn't say we understand your need for vengeance and violence and how upset you are. It starts from a kind of position of moral supremacy, which is, I'm against the death penalty, but the reason I'm against the death penalty is I'm a morally better person than you are. In other words, and if you say that to other people, you know what the response is? No, you're not. So the point is that if you look at a lot of the left response to this, it sort of amounted to sort of like somebody who would just watch your child get run over and running out in the street and saying, boy, I'm sorry, but that was really your fault, and let me tell you all the ways it was your fault. In other words, you don't just go past the episode itself to do all the explanation of all the reasons why you should do something else about it. You have to start where people are and say, I understand how you feel. I feel the same way. But here's what we should do about it. And a lot of people, in effect, on the left, and certainly the anti-war left, simply went from stage one to stage two without ever stopping to pause. And it's what I call, I quoted my brother Harry on this once, the singer, you always hear the great expression, he always used to say, surprise me. And I said, the thing is that a lot of people on Wednesday, after the Tuesday episode, said exactly the same thing that they would have said on Monday. In other words, they said, this just proves that I was right. The Wall Street Journal literally wrote that this shows that tax cuts are more needed than ever. In other words, and if all you had to say after an episode of such drama and such power was, this proves I was right all along, then you're not very interesting.
One of the things that struck me about the left response also is that it completely ignores what's actually happening and the deafness of the Bush administration's response. For instance, one of the first things that the left said is, we don't want to just have vengeance. So Bush said, yes, we're not going to have vengeance. We're not going to hit civilians. We're going to build a coalition with Muslims. This isn't an anti-Muslim war. They went to great pains, except for the military secrecy about targets, but they went to great pains to demonstrate that they weren't actually hitting civilian targets. Then the left said, well, you really should be dropping food on these people. So they said, okay, we'll drop food on these people. Then you should really be protecting the civil liberties of Arabs and Muslims. Okay, I'll protect the civil liberties of Arabs and Muslims. It seems like the Bush administration has responded to every left criticism because of realistic and pragmatic political needs to build a coalition around this effort. And the left just continues to ignore it, calls it a unilateral war of aggression that we're bombing civilians when it's absolutely not true.
Well, there is a tendency to there are two sort of alternative tendencies that every group has when it considers its opponents. One is to assume that they're real geniuses, the other is to assume that they're real idiots. And they're both equally wrong. That is, for instance, there's a which is, oh, this is what Bush wanted all along. Now, all the evidence is Bush had absolutely no desire to have this happen. This wasn't the policy he wanted to have to carry out. He was not interested in multilateralism. He would have rather stayed at home, not been in a foreign war, and, you know, cut taxes for rich people, which is what he really wanted to do. He's pretty explicit about that. However, being forced into the situation, he's actually responded fairly deftly to the new, you know, he's been pragmatic. He's responded to what needs to be done. And by the way, one of the things that need to be done is you have to show the American people that you, in fact, are doing something. Now, the irony is he hasn't really done all that much compared to the way American people feel. You know, and despite the fact he's drawn this sharp distinction between the way he's acted and the way Bill Clinton acted, I mean, what's he done? He's done a little more bombing than Bill Clinton did in the same circumstance, you know, when the embassies went up in 98. And he's sending 100, you know, guys, and he's run around the world, you know, having a lot of conversations. In other words, a view which shows that America is acting in some insensate way or something is exactly the opposite of reality. It's actually acting in a very measured and not very dramatic way. Even the bombing has not been, ironically, the bombing has not been that severe, partly because there's not that much in Afghanistan to bomb anyway. That means everything that was in Afghanistan to bomb was already bombed by the Russians 20 years ago.
Jim, I really want to thank you for joining us today. I'm talking now with Gail Madwin. She's the founder and webmaster for an organization called Queer by Choice, which advocates a social constructionist view of sexuality open to individual choice. So, Gail, how did you come to be an advocate for social constructionism as opposed to the more common essentialism? And could you also tell us a little bit about what those two points of view are?
When I was 15, then I was not happy with the idea that love has to be based on body types, and so I wanted to be queer, and I chose to be queer. I've been queer for 9 years now.
And when you say queer, you mean by that what? You're a lesbian, you're bisexual?
I am bisexual.
Uh-huh. And does queer hold a broader category of things for you than gay and bisexual, or is that the...
I use it primarily to mean gay, bisexual, transgender, whatever, but it could mean any kind of rebelling against mainstream views.
Mm-hmm. Gender and sexual norms.
Yeah.
Now, the social constructionist view would have it that this is more of a, it's not necessarily a choice, but more socially and psychologically determined than biologically determined. But you're taking that one step further. You're not just a social constructionist. Because if you're a social constructionist, you could feel like, you know, you're formed at a fairly early age and it's difficult to change after that, right?
Yeah, you could. Basically, social constructionism is just observing that different cultures have different percentages of people who feel attracted to the same sex. And so, obviously, it can't be strictly biological, as in everybody is born this way because they don't have different genes in these other societies.
Mm-hmm.
And choice is more me talking about my experience and saying I have control over this and I feel that I have had control over this and I remember making these choices.
When you say you have control over it, when you were a teenager, did you have primarily heterosexual feelings and then you say,
yes,
you did?
Uh-huh.
And then you said, I don't want to be this way. I think that this would be better if I had more interest in women.
Right.
And so did you consciously try to re-engineer your thinking? How did that occur?
Well, I had a best friend who I cared about a lot platonically, and I just thought it would be terrible if we had to be separate and we had to each go and marry other people, and then I wouldn't see her as much. And so I thought, well, it would be good if I could fall in love with her. And so I just thought about that more. And it's basically about recognizing that sex is not just some kind of instinct. It's more about expression of feelings. And if you have feelings of affection, then you can express that sexually.
Now, when I was in high school, I remember what an eye-opener it was the first time that I read a gay romance novel, because around us, pervasive in the culture, in the street, on the television, everywhere, there's numerous examples of heterosexual romance and the normalization of heterosexual romance, but very few examples of parallel gay romance. So did you also try to, and have found in your own life and in the lives of those on your mailing list, that surrounding yourself with a more balanced view of the possibilities of romance is a part of this?
Oh, definitely. Also, it's just that whenever people are put in a situation where they have the opportunity to explore same-sex feelings, then they tend to, like in prison in a all one-sex school, or in the 1950s when the teenage girls were not really available sexually, then the boys would have circle jerks. There's all this, these places where people have this opportunity to explore sex more easily with the same gender than the opposite gender, they tend to do that. And so whenever you are not being pressured also to just lean towards only opposite gender sex, then you're more likely to find that you enjoy both.
Now, recently there's been a great hoo-ha over these two studies at the American Psychiatric Association about gay to straight conversion. A gay and lesbian-sponsored study found that only 3% of people that they looked at were successful at converting from gay to straight, and a Christian reparative therapy-oriented study or study of people who had gone through these reparative therapy organizations found a much higher proportion of success. Do you think that these studies have implications for the social constructionism versus essentialism idea of gay identity?
First of all, I don't think there's very much information on the percentage who are successful, because they didn't have random samples in the Robert Spitzer study.
Right.
Basically, I tend to believe the ex-gay people, whatever they say about whether they have successfully developed opposite sex feelings, but I also take note that a lot of them say they haven't. And I think it's a very different process to try to choose to be straight than to choose to be queer, because the people who are trying to choose to be straight are generally very much afraid of their same-sex feelings, and they're trying to run away from them. And I think that when you're trying to run away from your fears, you can't really ever totally run away from it. You can maybe develop some other feelings, but you're always going to be afraid of this other thing. And if you don't overcome its power to haunt you, then you're not going to feel, I think, that you have totally changed. And I think when people are choosing to be queer, then they're doing something that they're not afraid of. They are facing their fears, and they're growing in a much healthier way.
Well, now, when I was in college, it was a very progressive liberal arts college, and there were a number of women who we referred to as political lesbians, women who didn't seem to be overly interested in having sex with women, but considered that it was the politically correct thing to do, to become a lesbian in that environment. So there must be some microcultures of American society where the pressure to be gay is as intense as the pressure to be straight is in most of the rest of the society.
Maybe a few, not very many anymore.
that's pretty true. Now, the folks who are a part of the Queer by Choice website and mailing list and so forth, would you say that most of them are folks who had that same trajectory that you had, that they were folks who were primarily heterosexual but decided for political, ideological, personal reasons to adopt a more bisexual lifestyle, or are some of them folks who are gay who are upset with or opposed to the more essentialist view of sexuality?
I would say probably around a quarter to maybe a third of them are more similar to me, in that they started out feeling more straight and then chose to chose to be queer more consciously, and the rest of them would be more, they had more of a traditional coming out experience in that they felt that they were born gay or whatever. They started out at least feeling gay first. Those were their first feelings after puberty, and then they just looked back on it and said, I don't think that this is biological, though, and I think that other people could have chosen it later in life or that I could choose differently. So they look at it that way.
One of the complaints that I've always had with the essentialist viewpoint is that it subculturalizes the gay community as opposed to posing a much more radical challenge to sexuality as a whole. If you can say to everyone, look, the world would be a happier place if we all were more in touch with our the dual natures of our personalities and our dual affectional possibilities, that's a much more radical thing to say to society than that you're either gay or straight, figure out which one and go join the appropriate community.
Yes, and I think as long as the straight people around us are running away from their own internal queer possibilities, then I don't think that they relate to us as wholly as it would be better for them to. And I think when they have queer kids, then they are not as prepared to deal with them as they would be if they could deal with their own queerness. Also, the whole idea of I don't have a choice, and so that's the only reason that I have rights is just very offensive. And people should more respond to this kind of suggestion that you have to choose to be straight by saying something like, well, if heterosexuals aren't born that way and they have the ability to choose to be queer, then why should the heteros get special rights?
I really want to thank you for joining us, Gail. And the organization is queerbychoice.org.
.com.
And there's a mailing list, and you have some other reading materials there.
Yeah, it has 100 numbers on the mailing list.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.
Focus, and I'm nowhere.